The Market Musings Podcast. Well, welcome back onto the Market Musings Podcast here from Stopbox, where Malcolm Palais is joining us again from Coincilium. Malcolm, how are you? It's good to be talking again.
And good to speak to you too, Mark. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you, Malcolm. Very good. And Alan Green, of course, is joining today. How are you, Alan?
I'm very good, thank you, Mark. Yes, nice and sunny here.
Oh, good. Yeah, I heard it was sunny in the UK. It's not where I am, in the Netherlands. Malcolm, what's it like in Gibraltar?
Well, I'm actually in London at the moment, so similar weather to Alan's.
Okay, nice. Yeah. Well, thank you for talking to us again. I know we're going to focus a bit more on this podcast about Web3, what it's all about, talk about the different iterations of the web, and of course what Coincilium are working on. But before we get into that, of course, the Bitcoin halving was only last weekend, wasn't it? I think, not even a week ago, and that's all gone through. And the Bitcoin price really just kind of stayed kind of where it is, isn't it? It hasn't really moved so much yet.
I don't think anyone who's been through these halvings before expected any great shakes. It's not something that can have an immediate impact. It's a technical thing, you see. When the future rewards are reduced from that date onwards, or halved effectively, it changes the efficiencies and the economies of the of Bitcoin. So everyone in the space, particularly the miners, are impacted on it, but the last people to be impacted are the markets, because they have to wait for the process to work through, where there's less Bitcoin rewards awarded. So you need to sort of see what happens with the costs for miners, and also the impact on the their economies, because they're the first to be hit. But it's interesting because the model we've seen in the past is playing out very similarly, because it does put the emphasis on efficiencies for miners. So the mining rewards are kind of given to the miners for the service they provide effectively in protecting and the network, and this whole process is it's quite an elegant structure, but it is quite complex. But in effect, every block that is hashed is the Bitcoin rewards are half what they were before. So what we have now is a much more mature mining sector than we had 4 years ago, with dominant players. And there's quite a few of them that are very large listed public companies, mostly in America. I've got their tickers here. There's Marathon Digital is one of the largest, and Griffon Mining are large as well, but there's also several others. But what happens now is the larger ones, as in kind of any industry, would want to take advantage of their dominant position to sort of in a predatory way take advantage of the smaller miners, who will be less efficient, because it is a very much an economies of scale industry. So the prediction I've seen going around something like a 15% of mining capacity to shut down from some of the smaller miners. And of course, the larger ones who've got the economies of scale will benefit from expediting and encouraging that to happen. Now, how can they do that? Well, miners have got invariably a lot of debt. Or at least that's how it's looking, and they certainly have costs, and they have if they want to keep the Bitcoin, they somehow have to finance their operations without selling them. So the forced selling of Bitcoin impacts the market straight away, but it also impacts the value of what the miners are actually working to produce, which is Bitcoin. So a little bit like sort of you get a price war with airlines when they sort of compete and push their costs below the cost of production. You know, at some time their fares, you know, EasyJet will put out a fare of £20 return. This is what sort of kind of happening in a different way here, where if those smaller miners have got energy costs, which are now reported to be growing even faster because of the increased effort it's costing the miners to produce half the amount of Bitcoin, because the market's getting crowded, so the difficulty levels go up, which means it costs more to process to run the processors, and it effectively the cost of production is higher. I've seen some quotes saying that as of the 22nd of April, the average report, well, it's but from Capriol Investments, reported an electrical cost of $77,400 per Bitcoin mined on the 22nd of April. Now that means that that's 11,000 more than Bitcoin was trading at that day. So yes, if you're going to actually participate and mine at that level, then you're going to be losing money. And because of the halving, you know, it's going to make it more intense. So it's going to be a kind of a war going on. Envisage that that will take a little while to play out. And whilst that's happening, the other thing miners will need to do is possibly sell their Bitcoin to keep their mining operations going, or their treasury, or sell or borrow or you know, eat into their reserves. But one thing's for sure, when they talk about the, you know, expect 15% of the capacity to shut down, it doesn't shut down completely, but it means that those miners who are sub-efficient will lose their market share or their share of the product. So this will all work through. But of course, that will create a coil spring effect, because what actually happens is that you can only suppress the price, or they can, or for so long, and they can't necessarily control the price, because there's lots of other factors going on, like the ETF demand, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, these things happen in waves, and there's lots of moving parts. So this whole process will probably take, I would say, a month or two to work through. And then the costs obviously have to be covered, and the price of Bitcoin will reflect that. So we expect a cold spring effect, and, you know, I can't say when it'll happen, but I think the price will start moving through the previous all-time high up to the 100,000, because that's where the energy costs are going to sort of start settling.
Is that 77,000? Was that an average, Malcolm?
Well, it was according to the this report. I don't know where they get their data from, but they publish it, and they can But if you Google Capriol, Capriole Investments, you will see they said that on the that was the what the costs were on the 22nd of April.
Okay.
Malcolm, would that also sort of apply to companies that are operating in Labrador, areas like that, where they can take advantage of green hydro energy? Are those the sort of prices that they're looking at there too?
To be honest, I don't know. I think that they, obviously not everyone pays the same amount, but it's an average. But the key is that unless you get your electricity for free, then there's always going to be a cost of production. And whatever that is, you know, it's going to require smart operations to actually, you know, possibly use some kind of recycled energy, or as you say, places like Labrador might have more efficiencies. But this is all, you know, an economic models working out. So those with the greatest efficiencies will always be the winners. And the dominant players at the moment are likely to be the ones who have the greatest buying power and the ability to seek out the most efficient locations to actually put their data centers in and work it out. And don't forget the way the mining works, it's only every block is only one reward. So you have to be in some kind of a pool, a little bit like with premium bonds. My parents bought me premium bonds when I was born. I've never won, because I've only got about £30 worth. And £30 worth when I was born is a lot more than it is now. Mm. You know, I know people who've had premium bonds and they win, you know, 2-3 times a year, because they've got much more in, you know, exposure to them. Mm. And it's the same with mining. The more processing power you have, the more rigs you've got running, the more likely you are to win that elusive reward for every block, and the fees that go with it.
Yeah, I was going to say there are economies of scale with that too, of course, aren't there? So if you're a bigger operator, you can buy get your power for less. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it. And overall, I think medium term, short term, a little bit kind of no man's land. We'll just have to let this wash through. But once this washes through, and it's happened before, you'll start seeing the, as always, the value will out. The market will kind of sort of start taking these things into effect. So that's what
Typically,
I'd
how long would
expect.
it take to wash through, or is it always
It's
different?
hard to say.
Yeah.
It just depends how much, if you're trying to starve someone of oxygen, how long do they run out of oxygen? That's a very morbid analogy, but that's really what it is. It's still the mine,
Okay.
these inefficient miners decide. Some of them might say, right, that's it, we'll close down, and that then that capacity goes to someone else. Some might sort of think they can sit it out, and it's a very cutthroat business.
Yeah. Well, we'll see, I guess.
I mean, if I had to say, I'd say a couple of months would be the most,
Okay.
because it is a very fast moving
Yeah,
industry.
okay.
That's my personal view, but
Sure.
I've been wrong.
Sure. Okay. Okay.
So yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Malcolm. Thank you for that. It's always nice to get insights on Bitcoin and crypto. We are here to talk about Web3, though, aren't we? Really. And this is off the back of Coincilium releasing a couple of reports, echoes of the 90s internet boom and opportunities in Web3 for new advertising models. I do like the image, by the way, on that one with the kind of the high street there and the Web3 shop and the bazaar. I think it's a very nice graphic.
We got those generated by ChatGPT, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes. I mean, the guys who did it for us, got that together. But that's what it can do. You give it all the prompts, and
Yeah.
those images come up. But
Wow.
it's excellent. It's sort of it gives you a lot of creative opportunities. So yeah.
Indeed.
So we announced the this news about these reports. I think was it just want to see when we announced it. See, on
That
the
was
3rd of
early
April.
in, yeah.
3rd of April,
Third of April. So this is an initiative that we decided that we were going to kind of enter into, because what we felt was that this is our focus. As our website was new website was launched last year, but the focus, we've said, was on Web3, and a lot of people didn't really appreciate at the time what Web3 was. Now a lot of people are becoming more familiar with the term, but what was apparent was that if we're going to be positioning ourselves in this space, we need to explain a lot more to the layman what it is, what the significance is, and what the potential is. So I always, when I prior to my role as chairman of Coincilium, I was a private investor, and I used to spend an awful lot of time doing research, and a lot of research isn't always that easy to actually access, and you go down rabbit holes or whatever. So I wanted to sort of get something done that was concise to actually spell out the opportunity and what it is, because Web3 is a very fast emerging area, and it's a kind of, if loosely used as an umbrella term, for a lot of things happening in the cryptos and blockchain space, because Web3 essentially is a new iteration of the internet, which is powered by blockchain. So this is kind of the vision. When people, were saying, what does blockchain do? You're starting to see the first iteration of a real business case. There's a lot of other things going on as well, certainly on the ledger side, but this is, with a combination of the potential of the technology and tokens for a kind of native currency for Web3 platforms, you're starting to see the building blocks coming together. So we thought we'd put some reports out, and we will be putting out a few more. The first we report we two reports were, should we start with, echoes of the 90s internet boom. And I would urge all investors to download these reports. They're free. They're available on the Coincilium website. You just have to go to the website and to the presentation section. and you can click on the link there and download it. And there, the first one sort of explains what Web3 is, in effect, and certainly in terms of the internet. So we broke down what is generally kind of referred to as Web1, Web2, and Web3, three iterations, and we've sort of rather snappily, hopefully, titled them. Web 1 was the information economy, which was really a way of you putting up a, where everyone started putting up websites, which were like brochures. They had their information about their presence, so you had a presence in a virtual world. It's quite limited, but it was certainly a revelation because it also included email as well. So you had this whole emerging kind of a new dynamic going on. And that sort of took us through to the early 2000s, when you started seeing what we refer to with Web2 as the platform economy, which was incorporated a lot of e-commerce. And then once mobile sort of came in, a lot of the solutions were going onto apps. And so you had most consumption moving in the from 2010 onwards onto mobile and onto apps. And then you had what, as I said, we refer to as the platform economy. And the Web3 is the next iteration, which will be the own, what we refer to as the ownership economy. So I think, you know, just to kind of go through the issues that we're currently experiencing as Web2 has matured, I want to give you some figures which actually underpin our investment case for us in pursuing this avenue of actually the more democratized version of the internet and what it can do. So right now, today, 1% of social networks account for 95% of social web traffic, and 86% of mobile use. The top 1% of search engines account for 97% of search traffic, and the top 1% of e-commerce sites account for 57% of e-commerce traffic. Outside of China, Apple and Google account for more than 95% of the mobile app store market. And in the past 5 decades, this is the key, the past decade, the five biggest tech companies grew from 25% to nearly 50% of the market cap of the NASDAQ 100. So who are these guys that we're talking about? We're talking about Alphabet, yeah, which is the parent of Google and YouTube, yeah, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Facebook parent, and Instagram parent, and Twitter, now mm-hmm. rebranded as X. So yeah, you've got a very, very, what started off as a sort of democratized kind of network, which was the internet, is now dominated by these players. And the combined revenue of the five largest social networks, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and Twitter, is about $150 billion a year. And nearly all these networks have got what they refer to as take rates, which means effectively that they either have 100% of the revenues generated, or in the case of YouTube, you know, that 45% is given back, but they own the platform and they deplatform people as well. So this is kind of, there's a lot of imbalance. And by the way, these quotes and these figures I'm taking from an excellent book by, that's just been released by a chap called Chris Dixon, who is founder of A16Z, and he's a VC, and his business is also, his focus is on what the iteration of this new internet is. And it's a great book called Rewrite Own by Chris Dixon. I would urge anyone who's interested in the sector to get themselves a copy. In fact, we will be hopefully you know, talking more about this, because reading this book, it sort of gives you the entry into this much, much earlier than a lot of people would even sort of be expected to get, because it's still going to be several years before this matures, but it's going to be sort of growing. It's already growing very fast. So that's sort of the background, and what the Web3 actually offers is a way of using blockchain and democratized networks, where everyone who's involved becomes a stakeholder through tokens, and you don't have those large players owning the network. They're owned by the people who are in them. So it's kind of a more community-based kind of experience, and that's what the vision, the big vision is for that. So that's why we thought we'd put these reports out, so that people can learn about what it is that we are sort of pursuing here, and how, on a practical level, on a commercial level, we believe that we can actually generate returns for investors.
There's a huge opportunity here, isn't there? I mean, I'm looking at this report here. You're because you mentioned those five players representing 50% of the market. The decentralized global social network market expected growing value from $12 billion last year to $101 billion by 2033, which is compound annual growth of some 23.5% per annum. I mean, that's incredible. How do you see it evolving? Because what we're effectively seeing here is that everyone is taking control of this. Everyone will be able to utilize it to their own ends and earn for themselves in some way. How do you see the mechanics of this playing out, Malcolm?
In what respect? In how will it they compete with the incumbent Web2 operators, or how will it?
Well, I mean, one would assume that the incumbent Web2 operators will see this coming, know it's coming, and they'll be making preparations for it. So could we not end up with a situation where, say, the likes of Google and Alphabet and X simply evolve and change their platforms and strategy to address this? Or is it something that will be out of their control?
One thing's for sure, they're not going to sit there and roll over and say the game's up and we're going to move on. And these are the biggest companies in the world.
Yeah,
so they will have something to do about it. But I don't think it's the way cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin evolved, you know, no one can stop them when there's enough people that actually adopt them. What they really would need to do is look at their economic models and the way they operate, and they'd probably revise that. So as an example, I think they're already looking at, certainly in the case of Facebook, who, you know, use all your data, use all your content, and they create ways of harvesting that data and making their share of that $150 billion a year. And Twitter, Instagram, they all do the same thing. And it's not necessarily just about the money, because people don't get involved in social networks to earn money. Not everyone does. A lot of people do it because it's an outlet for them, and it's part of their life. It's a very embedded part of their life these days. So it may well be that these networks, these large players, have to see their models evolve, where they give something back to their community and or the people who use their platforms, or change the model to some degree. But they will always be custodian models. They will always be owned by those players, and they will just say, okay, it's the economics have changed, the markets change, we have to now discount, give something back, change whatever we're doing. But the key is that because they're sort of predominantly built on advertising models, they have no real alternatives that are effective to, it's a struggle for the likes of Twitter and Facebook to get people to pay premium for the service, because over the years, everyone has become conditioned to getting things streaming for nothing, next to nothing, whatever it is. You know, even someone who tries to sell you an app and for £2, whatever it is, you might resist it, because people are used to getting things for free or near as free. And once they're on a subscription, they're very sensitive to that as well. So it does.
I think the blue tick verification worked quite well, though, for certainly for X and for other players, because it kind of gives people a sense of one up. They get some extra features. I think that was rolled out quite effortlessly, really. So it was a good source of revenue for them.
What do you pay for a blue tick?
It's £9.99. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. If you see that you get value for it, then so be it. You know, you'll pay $120 a year. But a lot of young people who use the social media networks are not used to paying for these things. So
fair
I
comment.
Think, you know, your application is more because of it's a professional service rather than a personal service.
Yeah, that's fair comment.
So, you know, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a challenging model because the social media has gone down a route which is advertising. And anything subscription, which it could have done early on, has kind of been jettisoned. So it's not going to be easy to get back to that that space. Mm. So, you know, that's key to actually sort of where we are, because Web3 will be also about value and ownership. And if you're on Web3, say you're a retail store or, you know, an online retailer, and you're paying. Which is not unusual for global brands to pay millions to Instagram because of their reach. You will have the opportunity to actually effectively own a piece of real estate in a new social network where you will have actual be part of it. And if that grows to critical mass, then you're more of a freeholder in that space because all you need is one of these kind of competitive platforms in that is blockchain driven to actually gain traction, and then what you have is you're part of the economy, so you'll get rewarded for your content, you'll get access to the market, you'll also have control over your own data, you'll get to decide how you want to actually have that data be used. So you might be approached by an aggregator who's looking to offer brands access to or this is moving on to our other report now, which is new advertising models of Web3. So if I move on to that, I'll explain how that can work, because what you have particularly with Web3 is the capability of using on-chain data analytics to actually look at wallets and what are in wallets, digital wallets, and then target advertising to those wallets, because those wallets are kind of transparent. It's not something where there's privacy issues. And also it is by design the way that blockchain and Web3 works. So the role of on-chain analytics, which is particularly interesting because we've created through our social network kind of syndicate, an advertising marketplace called AdBazaar, which again is talked about in the reports, and it will allow
Buyers and social media project, which incorporates AdBazaar,
So AdBazaar will allow detailed granular targeting based on assets held in a viewer's digital wallet. So it'll improve the relevance of ads, but also enhance the efficiency of advertising spend. You can also incentivize engagement. So you can actually target someone who say, like, you know, you fast forward and you say that tickets will be in this format. So if you know someone's going to a particular concert or a wallet has got a ticket or a souvenir from a particular concert or music artist, you can then target and make them offers. So you can actually say discounts, and you can give them tokens that can actually directly be spent through that advertiser's services. So there's lots of things in there you can do with on-chain analytics, and that's why we've tied up with one of the largest crypto advertising providers who's AADS, and the technology created by a company called Linko, which is again part of the project, and they will enable this targeting of ads with on-chain analytics, and it has the potential, which is what one of the partners was talking about, of creating a new Web3 version of Google Ads. That's how this could work. I mean, it's slightly different, but it isn't in, you know, you still use those models of bidding for space or whatever, but what you, and I'm not an expert on advertising by any means, but I'm learning as to on the basis of what everyone's going through here. So you'll be able to, you know, use these characteristics and the potential of the technology to do all sorts of interactions with users, which you can't possibly do now. So, you know, if someone wants to watch an advert, you might be able to pay them for it. You might be able to let them reward them for participation and give them discounts. So there's lots of things that can be done with this technology.
So theoretically then, as holders of NFTs or various NFTs, including Gibraltar stamps and other bits and pieces, we could effectively use that system or that network to identify, say, NFT collectors and stamp collectors and the like, and just push our wallet out to them, and they can see that maybe we offer a discount for Saturday and Sunday, and they can snap the NFTs up if they want to.
Yeah, I mean the ones they're talking about are sort of the very valuable ones. If someone's got a new project and they've got some artwork that they think might be of interest to a Bored Ape kind of collector, they can target those. And those, by the way, those owners of the wallets would sign up to allow them to be targeted.
Sure.
So part of that process, but you know, so it's permissioned. And once you're in there, you'll get all sorts of the capability for all sorts of offers to be engineered. But the key to this is that, you know, we've got big players in this. So big players are fleshing this out, which is, you know, it adds to the critical mass. And we'll hopefully have another report coming out next week and some others. This will be the format for reports we'll be putting out on all of our portfolio of both investments and advisory portfolio as well.
Okay, so could, in terms of evolution, we were talking just now about you know, how will Google, how will X address this issue? Could you see them adopting a model similar to the Byzantine Social Media Project? Would that be the route they go down?
I think they'll probably have to adapt the model to fit with their commercial operations. Don't forget they are owned by their shareholders.
Yeah.
So their shareholders are going to be looking for returns through whatever method is the most profitable for them. This is likely, as it evolves, to be seen as a threat. So, you know, if they start having to sort of share revenues with users, that's a different model. They might introduce a kind of a centralized version of this solution, which is probably the most that they can do, and tokenize things. And I'm not saying it'll necessarily not be efficient. It could be very effective. It could be very effective. But the key is it will always be centralized. And these new models are decentralized. And I think that our expectation is that the market, once they experience decentralization in a way that's as effective as and efficient as a centralized model can be, they will start thinking more likely why do they need to have a middleman involved who is still harvesting their data to some degree, or has the
and charging commission as well, or however.
So I'm not saying that, you know, don't get me wrong, we would, Coincilium is a, you know, very small company in the overall scheme of things, would not be going out banging the drum and trying to launch Web3 on its own. We're a small part of a very large movement, but we are we're becoming quite an influential part. And we because it's so early on, we can actually leverage some of the biggest names in the space. As with any industry, we did very similar things when we launched in crypto. Eddie, particularly with his connections and contacts in the space, goes back to day one, to the dawn of time. And we hope and expect that, you know, being involved in some of the very earliest, with the very earliest movers in the Web3 movement, we'll also be able to, you know, sort of get involved in things that perhaps will not be available to us 3-5 years down the line when the industry is much more mature. And, you know, the key is there's some very big money going to this space as well. So, you know, we actually, you know, feel this is a bit of a sweet spot for us.
Sure. So what do you see as being the key steps, the key next steps for Web3 to evolve?
Well, it's got to sort out the user experience and the user interface. Because at the moment, a lot of the kind of engagement tools are quite complex and quite clunky, as you would expect at the beginning of any new industry evolution. And this is why with Endorse, our tech partners and also investee company are building tools for, that can be used for Web3, which make things easier. One of them is an abstraction wallet software development kit that they've Endorse created for Byzant called Bastion, which is going to make wallets easier for people to use without the necessity of having a, you know, that 12 word key phrase, and these will be browser integrated. So these wallets will be a lot easier for people to interact with. The advertising network, again, is another thing that can be deployed through through Byzant, but also through other networks as well. The key thing about Web3 is collaboration. You won't have people sort of being proprietary because it won't work. You won't get the scale if and those that do try and act in a proprietary way without operating in silos and not collaborating will find themselves in the minority and sort of in a bit of like the walled garden model, and doesn't work for this space. You do have to approach it with an ethos of collaboration and in the true spirit of decentralization. So that's really key to it. We'll be looking at building the picks and shovels, and also doing what we can to actually engage with some of the biggest players who are, you know, committed to this space and also starting to see that we exist. You'll start seeing a lot more, but you're already seeing on social media some of the people we're rubbing shoulders with, which is quite important. And again, you know, it's timing is everything. You won't be able to do this in 3-5 years time because the industry will be more mature. But we're setting our seat at the table at the earliest time when it's starting to get traction.
Excellent. Any thoughts, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Sort of new technology. I mean, is it fair to say, Malcolm, that whereas sort of, or as well as, you know, crypto sort of came in and decentralized the financial, or the sort of the money markets, it's still working on that, you know, but it did definitely disrupt it and decentralize the financial cash race basically and money. Yeah. Is that what Web3 is doing really? It's the decentralization of the internet away from the big players, decentralization of data. Can you draw a similar sort of comparison there?
Yes. I mean, you know, it's an analogy that works on a high level.
Yeah.
It's doing, if you consider what crypto has done in for financial services, it's not nowhere near there yet, and there's a lot of regulatory challenges as well. But there are a lot of people who use it and use crypto on a practical basis. It's not just about the speculation. I mean, you know, that's a major aspect to it. But you know, what you're seeing here is the utilization of blockchain to solve a problem. And it'll only solve a problem if a problem's there. If people think and believe that social networks dominated by 5 players is a problem, not because of those 5 players, but because of what the experiences of people that are using them, and you know, the stuff we start seeing in the media more and more, government interventions, data privacy. Every time you download an app, every time you go onto a new social media platform, whatever you're doing, interacting, you know, or from time to time, Apple will send you an update, and then you'll scroll through 5 or 6 pages and then sign OK. Now, do you read that? Do you read those 5 or 6 pages? No one does. But the reality is what you're actually signing up for is for them to allow them to use your data. That's the permission you're giving them. So they use their data and then they give you permission to use whatever service that they're offering you. So if that's a problem, then decentralized social networks and blockchain can solve that problem. I'm not saying it won't be without other kinds of problems and challenges as things go by, because there will be. But the key is that, you know, you look at something that can solve a problem, and that's what's motivating particularly the largest players in this space. And I just refer you back to this book that I mentioned at Shah. That he can see. Well, this is audio anyway, but I'll repeat it if it's well worth getting. It's available on Audible as well. It's by Chris Dix, and it's called Read, Write, Own. And he spells it all out from the, you know, from the beginning of the internet to now, how we got here, and why he believes that this is the next iteration of the internet, utilizing blockchain and utilizing this token economy. He does draw a distinction, which is kind of prevalent, is that the cryptocurrencies, a blockchain, is actually kind of can be divided into two parts. One is the casino, which is, you know, the stuff that everyone focuses on, which is the price of cryptocurrencies, and the other is the computer, which is the actual utilization of the technology for the purpose which it which we're all sort of moving towards with Web3. Now, there'll be an element of, you can't separate the two, in terms of the, you know, one, but it's just different. They're different sides of the coin. But you will be using tokens within Web3, and tokens are cryptocurrencies. So you will be using them, but there'll be the use case for them as being the native currency of that social media platform.
Yeah, okay.
There'll be still be people buying cryptocurrencies for various different reasons, and you know what we talked about before with Bitcoin is, you know, that is a 1.25 trillion asset class now. And in 2008, it didn't exist. You know, it's given birth to Ethereum, because Ethereum is Bitcoin, but programmable. And that gave birth to ICOs, allowed ICOs to happen. So this whole area is blowing up. And the sort of, if I can leave people with a final thought or word, is that if you are serious about your investments and what you actually want to do and getting ahead of the next trend, you need to do your research. You need to understand what it is you're investing in. It's not enough to just be sit and watch the share price of a company go up or go down, not understanding why. But also, if you want to get into Web3 and you actually get the vision, you start researching now. Buy Chris Dixon's book, look at our reports, follow stuff on Web3, because it is that kind of journey that took me into Bitcoin in the early days in 2012 that ended up with me actually realizing, took me a year to actually realize that that was there was a future here. But I think people will start agreeing with us that Web3 is definitely got legs, and it's definitely the way forward.
Okay. I mean, it one of the applications reminds me of a company that we were talking to, who were in going into will be IPOing at some point. They're called Bolt. I don't know if you've heard of them, Malcolm, but they're Bolt. Yeah, as in lightning bolt. It's a platform for content creators, and they took us through the platform. Obviously, it's online. It's on television as well. And what they're saying is they want it enables content creators to get. Yeah, have a television channel and effectively monetize that. And I actually said, well, hang on, are you taking on YouTube here? And they sort of said, well, yeah, maybe. But it's a content platform for video based like YouTube, but all about the social network, you know, that comes with that. And of course, the blockchain and the tokenization of that, and getting rewarded through Bolt. So that concept, but it's not more than the concept, it's developed, it'll be a rolling out, well, it's already rolling out, but they're just continuously evolving it and IPOing it. But that's a good example, I think, of a Web3 application.
I don't know if it's Web3. I mean, ultimately, if it's Web3, it will need to be kind of have a blockchain element to it.
Yes, it has a blockchain. It does, yeah.
So then it's a question of whether it's a private blockchain or if it's a public blockchain.
Okay.
And then, you know, I'm not saying that private blockchains have got no place. It just depends on your ethos and your philosophy around it. We are inclined, although we are working with private blockchains as well. One of our advisory clients is building its own private blockchain for security. It feels it's the most secure way of doing things. But, you know, ultimately, there's a different ethos to using a public blockchain or a private blockchain. But it's not as, you know, it's not a deal breaker one way or the other. It's just purely about how the network works. Ultimately, if it works, it's efficient, it offers something, it solves a problem, people want it, then it'll work. providing the management know what they're doing and they're going to work hard and fast and make it happen.
Yeah.
So it's good to see a lot of this stuff. But ultimately, I think, you know, again, another takeaway is that when you've got these large players like we've discussed that are dominating this entire world, it will inevitably set up an effect, which will be what we're seeing now one way or the other, are people looking at how they can disrupt them. And, you know, it'll take a lot of work, but ultimately that's where the technology enables this to happen.
Right. Okay. Good. And I mean, we want to finish this off, and I want to just finish it off. But you said there earlier, I think you said sort of 3 to 5 years from the report, there is a few things, you know, that's got to happen. It's all about the Internet of Things, interlinking financial systems and tokenization. So this takes a while. And if we think on how investors can get exposure to the upside of this Web3 and what's to come down the pipe, of course, you're here representing Coincilium, and you know, I know we've talked a lot Coincilium, and you know, you've been involved in lots of different projects over the years. Why do you think that? I mean, I'm not saying the ones we've talked about in the past haven't gone anywhere. You know, the NFTs.
Some of them haven't.
The NFTs are still hanging around. I remember the Gibraltar stamp. Well, but I mean, what's the upside for you as Coin, investors of Coin? Is the focus going to be down Web3, and what's the upside that you can deliver to shareholders?
Well, it's I think you've got to look at every investment we've got has got a Web3 aspect to it. We did not necessarily by design. I mean, we've got an investment in a digital finance pioneer, which is Greengage, and they are a challenger bank, although they're not a bank, but they are inevitably going to be plugged into Web3 as it will become apparent, because payments operators need on-ramp and off-ramps. Decentralized finance is going to be part of Web3 as well. And likewise, Silta, which is an AI proposition, which is looking at infrastructure finance. It's going to eventually have touch points in Web3. But the thing about what we're doing, particularly with Byzant, which is the project that we are advising and we're working with as kind of on the founder level, is really going to be our main focus from an operational point of view. So what we'll have is we'll have investments that have touch points in Web3. We'll have a project that will be part of a significant project, which will have which we'll be working with as a kind of the founder level, which will be the focusing on Web3 going forward. So that will be the main exposure, I think. Okay. Plus the other advisory work we do, we always get our upside comes when they do their token launch, and we get paid in tokens on a success basis. And those have obvious Web3 aspects to it, because those tokens can be used. There aren't many companies that actually earn revenues in crypto. And so we've got sort of all we're firmly in that pool. And the exposure I think that shareholders would expect would be if we can make inroads to, apart from any appreciation in the value of our crypto, which is sort of our cash in the bank in the best currencies that you can have, which we would argue is Bitcoin and sort of some of the top ones, but nonetheless, you know, that's not really us working, that is us kind of preserving our assets, if you like, and our cash. It's not technically a cash equivalent, but they're available for sale quite readily on markets. But the exposure will come by being ready to ride the Web3 wave as it comes down the track. And importantly, we won't have to wait till this is a mature industry to be able to generate returns, because if we get in early enough, I'm not saying it's going to be a straight line upwards, but you know, there's all sorts of things going to come. But I don't know too many other propositions which give investors access to this market at this such an early stage. And also, we want the support of our investors to actually sort of what we want to sort of what we want to do is we want to engage and we want to educate and we want to inform our investors and our shareholders so that they understand why they're on that journey with us. They actually see all the aspects of it. And they, and, you know, I was talking to one of our shareholders the other day who wanted to meet up, and, you know, he's grilling me, as he rightly should. It's his hard cash in there. But the key, I think, takeaway was that he got a good understanding of what our business is and what the potential for us to actually sort of get access to this Web3 market at the early stage. And if he's convinced of Web3, which I believe he is now, and he believes that we are the right people to actually, we're competent enough and we know what we're doing and we actually are motivated to actually deliver the returns from that space, then that really gives shareholders a lot of comfort. If they just look at the share price and say it's gone up, it's gone down, but they don't actually understand as enough about the sector we're in, it becomes much harder to actually see things clearly.
Okay. Good. Well, thank you, Malcolm. I hope we can be doing some general interviews with you or the team at Coincilium as things develop on various projects.
Well, as I said, we hope to have some more reports out soon. We're just sort of finalizing those and getting them signed off. So, you know, we'll be releasing those regularly. And as, again, it's not always, you know, it's not always easy, but put some time aside to read them. I was joking with someone who said, if only we could actually say that in order to qualify to buy Coincilium shares, you have to have studied at Web3, which would be absolutely ridiculous thing.
Or just the Chris Dixon book,
Yeah, exactly. But all we could say is like urge people to do it because it does make the evaluation of the investment a lot easier.
Okay.
Hopefully you'll end up getting as excited as I am.
Good. And those reports are to be found in the, I think, the latest RNS link.
Website. Well, you can go to the RNS and that will link you to it. But the best way is to go to Coincilium website, scroll down to presentations, which is under the investor section. Click on that and you'll see the reports. You just click on them and download them then.
Okay, super. There. Thank you again.
And if you want to circulate them, by all means do.
Will do. Thank you very much, Malcolm, again, for your
thank
time.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings. Tune in next time.